Welcome to East Meets West, episode 177. I'm Tom Merritt.
And I'm Roger Chang.
And joining us from Paris, France, late into the evening there is Patrick Beja. Hey, Patrick.
Hey, how are you doing?
We're doing very well. Thanks for staying up so late to join us here.
It's a pleasure. I'm happy to do it anytime.
Patrick, how do you promote your stuff now that you're like an official Blizzard employee, but you've got other stuff going on as well?
Yeah, well, you know, I don't do anything Blizzard or video game related anymore, so I can just promote my Twitter feed and website. So twitter.com/notpatrick and the French Spin website.
All right. And but we're big fans. Probably East Meets West fans would be most interested in checking out the Phileas Club, which you do monthly still. Is that right?
Yeah. We do a few special episodes from time to time, but it's mostly monthly.
All right. Well, one of the reasons, Patrick, we wanted to have you on was to talk about this whole Nobel Peace Prize that kind of took everyone by surprise on Friday.
It was actually quite abrupt and totally out of nowhere for a lot of people. President Obama did get a Nobel Peace Prize earlier this week, and the nominations were actually due 12 days into his presidency, so it actually occurred a lot earlier.
Well, yeah, there's been a response.
The nominations were 12 days into his presidency, but the vote actually happened when they announced it, or a few days before, didn't it?
Yeah, I believe they've had a response to that saying, you know, this vote was taken very recently, and President Obama's actions at the United Nations factored into the decision, as well as a lot of the things that he's done so far. But the big controversy is he's only been in office since January. He hasn't done a lot yet. Some people say he hasn't done anything yet.
Well, the controversy is that the Nobel Peace Prize isn't for any kind of concrete consequence of his actions. It's based solely on his oratory skills and what he's promised to do. It's not like I've done this and this everyone can see I've accomplished.
Well, it's a little bit more than that. It's the fact that he is creating a new climate for international relationships.
Maybe, and, but I think it's a bit of a stretch to say, because there's previous instances in history where that's occurred, and this is the first time a Nobel Peace Prize has actually ever been awarded for this particular, I guess, role or category.
You're saying this? What are you trying to say, Roger? This is the first time they've ever given a Nobel Peace Prize to someone symbolically?
No, where they've actually given, even symbolically,
it's for a promise.
For what? Yeah. I mean, because he's... Yeah, you know, there's plenty of world leaders who've initiated a climate of détente or some sort of environment where communications and possible negotiations to diffuse a lot of tensions. And it's not to say that Obama isn't deserving, or 6 months down his work will bear fruit and we'll have peace accords in the Middle East. We'll have a lot of the kind of conflict zones around the world kept in check. But I mean, I think it's putting the cart before the horse. Honestly,
I think my reaction to this when I first heard about it was, what? That was my literal reaction, and I didn't really understand what happened there. What did he do? And I think someone on Twitter, I'm sorry, I can't remember who, explained it very simply. He said, he managed for an American president to not bomb anyone in the first year of his presidency, and that's enough apparently for the Nobel Peace Prize now.
Did Clinton bomb anyone in the first year?
No,
I mean, I think he waited till the second year to bomb Kosovo, right?
No. See, that's the thing.
He did bomb Iraq too. Clinton.
He bombed Iraq initially, and that was.
I don't think George Bush Jr. George W. I don't think he bombed anyone.
No,
in the
he
first
didn't bomb
year.
Anyone in the first year either. It's a stretch.
Facetious way of putting it, but I mean, I think. It's just because he's not George Bush, isn't it?
That kind of bothers me a little bit. Not so much that George Bush was a great guy, but in the same way that they nominated Carter for a Nobel Peace Prize as a kind of repudiation of George Bush's policies, I don't know. I mean, is this what...
Wait a minute. I thought they gave Carter a Nobel Peace Prize because of his work in building homes for poor people. I didn't think it was a repudiation
I mean, if you look at all the actual, you know, kind of critical analysis of it, it was kind of like, this is the kind of American we want, not George Bush. I mean, I
think... And that particular criticism there, I think, characterizes the over-analysis. And we, you know, in bringing up this topic at all and talking about it, we're engaging in that sort of over-analysis of the politicization of this.
I think, but
here's my question. Is there a way, if you just take politics out of it and take the emotions of we didn't like George W. Bush or we don't like Barack Obama, is there any way to justify giving someone an award of the stature of the Nobel Peace Prize for merely changing the tone of international debate? Because that's what the justification was.
No,
is there, you know, forget Obama, forget everybody else. Is there a way to do that justifiably?
Maybe it depends on how you define the Nobel Peace Prize to begin with. What is it supposed to reward? Is it actually achieving something that that creates peace in the world? If that's the way I understand it, he didn't bring anything in that department. He didn't do anything. Maybe he will, but, you know, that I don't think there's any way to justify it. And to be honest, the thing that surprised me the most, I saw the latest Real Time with Bill Maher earlier, and I thought that even the Democrats were going to be freaking out about it, because it undermines everything that they've been saying about him and offers an incredible opportunity for the Republicans to keep saying, you know, people are in love with Barack Obama for no good reason, and he's not doing anything. And I was amazed to find out that apparently some Democrats are trying to justify it. I don't think there's any way to justify it.
I agree with you halfway, Patrick, and my view is this. It's dangerous to give... Or not dangerous in the sense that someone's gonna, you know, flip over this, but I think it's dangerous because you're adding all these expectations on a number of issues that may or may not eventually reach where we want them to go, be it the Middle East, be it, you know, the Far East, Afghanistan, you know, parts of Central and South America. I think it's great. I think the kind of notion that someone is trying to do something positive is great, but, you know, I'm always reminded of the old adage of the road to hell is paved with good intentions. I'd sooner it be given, you know, once there's, you know, it doesn't even have to be, you know, Israel and the Palestinians signed a new accord, there's a Palestinian state, you know, in 3 months or anything like that, but there's actual kind of something
that would justify retroactively his peace prize. If he does that,
yes.
Okay. I don't know how they found out that would justify it, but I don't think that's going to happen. Although, you know, Cornel West, Professor Cornel West, suggested that it might be a way of keeping him in check, because now that he's got the Nobel Peace Prize, he might not be as likely to go out and start wars, or, you know, be more likely
Considering they gave it to Kissinger.
They gave it to Yasser Arafat. Mithrin Deer pointed that out in the chat room.
I really believe that they have their heart in the right place, but sometimes it makes me scratch my head to say, oh, what are you doing? Is this a way for you to... And this is the problem, is because Tom brought it up, you know, politicizing the process. Is a peace prize something that will always be politicized, you know, depending on which side of the argument you're on? Some people, well, he doesn't deserve the Peace Prize. He's killed all these people. Other people, well, he stopped a great war. He deserves a Peace Prize. You're going to always, I mean,
Woodrow Wilson got the Peace Prize for starting the League of Nations. That turned out great.
Yeah.
So, you know, maybe they should have waited on that one as well.
So, I mean, actually, the bigger question, though, is, you know, if, you know, will this in effect kind of give people a second pause at Nobel Peace Prize nominee is saying, oh, well, look, it's just another popularity contest. They chose the most popular person.
I think it already has.
I'm sorry.
I mean, people gave the example of Arafat a lot, and people seem to forget that there was a moment for a few years there where Arafat was really, you know, turning his back on terrorism and helping the peace process tremendously and going forward and forward. And it came to a point where it had never been before. And then at the last minute, it didn't work out, as we all know. But it's even for Arafat, it's a very different situation. I don't think there's ever been a moment where they gave out the Peace Prize to someone who never actually achieved anything. You know, they might have been misguided, wrong. It wasn't the right thing, the right person to give it to. But just for being cool and
are we being too results oriented here, where it's like, oh, you have to have this list of things? I mean, I just further refining that earlier question, not saying this is what I think even, but is the fact that the administration has come in and reversed so many policies, opened up so many channels of communication, sat down and talked with people that haven't been talked with in 8 years, and come into the United Nations and started talks on nuclear arms and started talks on Middle East, has that diffused so much tension and made so much more possible that you could say that's an accomplishment? Or are you guys saying, no, you know what, you got to show me something solid here?
You know, it's the thing is, if you watch politics, it's a cycle. There's tensions, there's a decrease in tensions, there's an increase in tensions. There's never going to be a period where, aha, that's the defining moment, that's the epiphany, where everyone just kind of said, oh, we get it, we understand. No more rattling the sabers, no more pulling out the AK-47s, no more threatening our neighbors with big missiles. I understand kind of the direction, the message. And this is, I think, really kind of what they were after, is the message they wanted to put out. Not so much to Obama, but to everyone else, like, hey, this is the kind of person we want. But, you know, when it comes down to actual results, you know, if Arafat and Shamir, was it Shamir that both got the Peace Prize, co-Peace Prize?
Yitzhak Shamir.
Yitzhak Rabin.
Was it Rabin? Sorry.
In the end, nothing came of it. I mean, they were back at square one. So
they were working towards it. I don't see what specifically Obama is working towards.
Well, he made that speech to the Muslim population, which got a lot of press, and he did a lot at the United Nations that impressed a lot of diplomats. So if you're talking about working towards, there is something to show there. Mm. If you're talking about results, that's a different matter.
It's intentions. He's got good intentions. He didn't actually sit... You wanted him to go arm in arm
with Ahmadinejad? Take a picture?
Well, getting, you know, look at what happened with Ahmadinejad at the G20. It didn't actually achieve anything in regards to Iran's relationship with even the world. We're not at that point yet. Certainly, it's necessary steps, and it's the right ones. But,
I'm totally with you, Patrick.
I love Obama. I mean,
it's one of those things where it kind of beggars belief, because you're like, you know, I know he had, you know, Obama is trying to do a lot of things to kind of turn the ship around, but none of those, not even dialogue terms. I mean, you know, he's opened his hand supposedly to Ahmadinejad, and you know what we get is a hidden, you know, nuclear.
Spit it out, Roger.
Sorry.
What? What are you trying to
the
hide?
What
are you trying to say over there?
Basically, there's been basically nothing concrete in terms of, okay, you know, you said you'd do this, we'll do this. I mean, there weren't even baby steps. It's still solely on a kind of there's the beginning of a dialogue.
So who would you have given it to?
The fact that we are even trying to understand the reason why he got it, to me, seems like something that is too tenuous to be justified. So we've been struggling for like what, 10 minutes to understand why he got it, and we still don't have a clue.
Who should have gotten it though? I mean, if you disagree that President Obama should have received it, who should have got it? You want Sarkozy?
I don't know. No. I'm not on the board of Nobel Peace Prizes. I'm not the one.
Just as alternatives, who else should have been nominated?
You, Tom. I think you should.
Yes. Nobel Peace Prize to Tom.
East meets West, win the Nobel Peace Prize.
Hey, you know what? That would be great for promotion.
Well, okay, so you guys can't think of anybody? So is that the problem? They just really didn't have an option?
Certainly they can find some guy who invented micro loans or something like
some
that.
Some doctor or somewhere. But yeah, but that's for economics. See, and that's the interesting thing, right? The Nobel Prize for the other sciences generally is given long after the work is done. So for instance, fiber optics, the man who invented fiber optics 40 years ago, I think, actually, won the Nobel Prize for that this year, right? Maybe they need to do that for the Peace Prize as well. Like, look, we're not going to give it to you until long. You know, maybe Kissinger should be winning it now for China rather than, you know, giving it away right away. But I nobody does spring to mind as being, you know, there's no Mother Teresa out there right now. Al Gore already got one. Who else is working for peace? Let me tell you who should have gotten it.
The American people should have gotten it for electing the first black president.
Well, how is that different than giving it to Obama?
It is very different. It's saying that as a people, the American people, a few dozen years after the end of segregation only managed to go so far as a society that they would heal the divide, even if it's not completely accurate. But that would have been a better, however tenuous, it would have been a better attribution. Wikipedia. Give it to Wikipedia. I don't know. It would have been better.
Actually, you know what? That's actually, well, not Wikipedia per se, but, you know, some sort of social networking tool.
Wait, you're going to give it to Facebook or Twitter?
Hey, now? That would be awesome. Right next to your face on Facebook would be a little Nobel Prize staring back at you.
You know,
I think the real...
Why not? It does do a lot for communication, you know, intercontinental country. Twitter, with the Iran thing, whatever.
The Iran post-election.
There is something to do in that space, I think.
Now it's turning into the Time Magazine something of the
year.
I
hate
you give it to the planet Earth.
No, you can give it to the computer, the personal computer.
How about we give it to the Apollo 11 astronauts?
Why not?
40 years later. Follow that model of giving it later. Give it to them for landing on the moon. Talk about, you know, putting us all in our perspective and giving us a chance to
think
about
peace. I think that's where all the medals should go. They should go and land on the moon. Like, just until we work as a unified human organization that can send people to pick them up. They'll just shoot all these medals toward the moon.
I think I know the real reason that they couldn't find someone else. I believe, I may be mistaken on this, Roger, but I believe was not Kanye West on the Nobel Committee this year?
Oh.
And he would have jumped up. He would have been like,
he would have taken it away.
I'm going to let you finish, but.
Tom, that's so 2 weeks ago.
Actually, isn't that 3 weeks ago or is it two? I guess it is 2 weeks ago.
Oh, it's about a month ago at this point. Too soon? No, too late.
Ah, Tom. So, I don't know if you get this show out in France, Patrick. But
out there in the provincials in France.
About Europe. But Stargate Universe, I watched the second episode. I don't want to talk about it if you've never watched it. Patrick, and you want to
watch. I have seen, let's say, very detailed reports of the first the pilot, and I liked it.
So detailed that you watched it?
It's like you watched it.
In my mind, yes. All right. Let's say that.
Well, Lack of Voice posted at subbrilliant.com/EMW. I never watched a whole episode of any Stargate show other than the movie. I happened to catch Universe, though, and was entertained, I think partially due to the fact that I have a need for anything more current. Visit the vis-a-vis, I think he meant to say, the Trek franchise. Voyager had its moment, just saying. I turned on the TV right after listening to East Meets West, flipped to the TV Guide channel, and what's on? Stargate Universe. Mostly people are giving positive reviews of it on East Meets West, but I've heard a lot of people trashing it. Joshua Hill says, I loved Stargate Universe, really cleverly done and interesting. I thought the second episode was not as good as the first. And some people thought I was hard on the first last week, and I actually liked it. The second episode had some really good moments, but it dragged through there's this desert scene where, as you can guess, they're all tromping through the desert with music playing and sweating because you may not have realized, totally. It's hot in the desert. Even on alien worlds.
And you don't have that much water on you. Actually, are there any big sci-fi series out going on in France currently, Patrick?
Well, not. Do you mean French or
just
or
like
American?
What's popular on French
television?
Either way,
anything, I think.
Like the stuff people are talking about.
There's a pretty faithful geek community that watches anything sci-fi, and we loved Battlestar Galactica. And by the way, yeah, Stargate Universe, the first pilot, was made a pretty good impression of Battlestar Galactica, and I don't think it's going to last. But there isn't anything that you guys have there that we have here. It's pretty much the same thing in the same proportions. You know, the world is a tiny village now, so we get basically the same things with a few months of delay.
There's no, like, French X-Files or French CSI with, like, Fringe tossed in.
No, not really. The problem is there are a few problems in TV production in France. The market is so much smaller that we don't have the resources to do quality TV. And the other thing is it's so much cheaper anyway to buy the shows that you guys have produced to begin with that it's very, very rare to have the French Mulder and what was her name?
Scully.
Yeah.
So, well, that's an interesting thought, right? Because if, let's say, you know, the state of Illinois decided, hey, we're going to just produce a bunch of TV shows in Chicago and make them for Illinois, it probably would not work either. So I get that, you know, France is a small enough market. But what about Europe? Is there not, you know, I mean, I know it's a there might be a language issue there, but if you, you know, if you can get American shows dubbed in English, what about making shows in English and marketing to all of Europe?
It's most well, yeah, that's an idea. And a lot of people start making movies in English, actually. In France, there's a quite a famous production company called Europa, which they did Taken with Liam Neeson a while ago. And they do their movies in English, but that's not happening for TV. And it's really just the language barrier. I mean, you were talking about Illinois producing a TV show. I'm sure it would work just as well. Well, if it was well produced,
I'm thinking because Australia does, you know, some sci-fi shows. Granted, they're not
UK big, does a ton, right?
Big budget, but I mean, Australia is like 22 million people. Comparatively, France has what 58, almost 60 million people. I mean, you would think.
Well, we have shows. I'm not saying we don't do any, but they're not as good quality as the ones you guys do. I mean, especially in the past, 10 years, mm-hmm. shows on TV have been getting so much better. It's amazing. They are now basically, for most of them, movies quality. And that's something that takes, I don't know if it's know-how or market or what, but we don't do that in France. And arguably in Australia, it's not that quality either. So there's
it's not. But I mean, even like with BSG, that was a co-financed production between Sky UK and the Sci-Fi Channel. Would it be, I mean, is there any kind of thing where, say, like France could tie in with like a Belgian company or a Quebec company, or like kind of to produce, you know, a common language show, but, you know, combining the financial resources, you know, of not just, you know, players within France, but also outside of France?
In France, in French, you mean? In French, yes. Language? Yeah, well, it does happen. I'm sure it happens, but still, it's a too small a market to make to really sink tons and tons of money. The kind of money you need to do a show like, I don't know, well, Battlestar Galactica, for example, or even things like The Sopranos or Damages or Dexter and stuff like that. You need really amazing production value for these shows to happen. And we have a few, you know, a station that's like HBO here in France called Canal Plus. They did produce a few, it's subscription based, and they did produce a couple of very ambitious TV shows, and they promote them as such, but it's very much the exception.
All right, Vor Adams on the subbrilliant.com/EMW blog says, are zombies the new vampires? With vampires becoming whiny emo girly men, is the horror and fear they used to inspire being hijacked by zombies? And he says, maybe this should be asked with Eileen's podcast. My wife does a podcast called Bite Club. But yeah, so I think this is an important issue of the day, a la the Nobel Peace Prize. Zombies in the ascendancy? Because we often think of it as a vampire-werewolf war.
It's, no, I mean, even the vampire-werewolf war is pretty recent. I mean, you know, way back with Lon Chaney, it was just kind of like, hey, there's another scary creature hunting me down. Then they kind of created these kind of idealized clans or groupings where one was pitted against the other. I think wasn't there kind of a political tie-in with zombies and vampires? Like, zombies always went up during Republican administration and vampires and... Hold on.
There is a tie-in with vampires in the recession. People tend to like vampire stories during a recession. It happened once before, and it's happening right now. That's just my tidbit.
There you go. So, an expert host of Bite Club, Eileen Rivera, her take on
it. So the fact that we're liking zombies now means that we're out of the recession?
Maybe we're climbing back up.
I'm going to turn myself into an analyst.
The zombie represents the resurrection of the economy.
No, I think zombies represent the yuppified masses who are so kind of into looking like everyone else. They're like zombies. You know, they'll buy certain brands. They'll only, you know, drive a certain car. In fact, they end up looking like clones of each other. And then vampires is just about the sucking sound, like in a recession.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense that you would like vampires during a recession because, you know, they don't have to eat as much. They save a lot of money. They can make long-term investments.
And they look good doing it.
Yeah.
No, but you know, to come back to the serious topic...
Yes.
Zombies can't really be the new vampires. They are slow. Well, maybe even if they're not slow, they're sort of silly and they have a one track mind. The new vampires are actual vampires, not that sparkly diamond skin crap that we're getting served now. The real vampires who are, and they don't need to be emos. Did you see 30 Days of Night?
Yes.
Oh yeah.
I love that. I love the comic book that was based on.
Are those vampires or zombies?
No.
Thirty Days of Night is the one out in Alaska. Yeah. Right, those are vampires. Yes, those. That's some real, like,
actually, it's interesting.
Salt of the earth vampires.
In the comic book, those vampires are actually more akin to mobsters than emo kind of whiny kids. They were kind of people in their late 20s, early 30s, and they had a very kind of, you know, it's our business kind of thing. You know, get it done. Don't let anyone know.
Can you do that voice again?
So, vampire mobsters, that's something HBO could tie in very well.
Yeah, I think even spin on Sopranos.
Even True Blood, which had so much promise. I mean, I like it, but it turned into, ooh, I'm a vampire, and I let you suck my blood, so now you love me, and I love you too, but I really can't. And that was so
schmaltzy. There are vampires in Sanctuary, actually. The show that just started its second season on Sci-Fi. They had to shoehorn some vampires in there at the end of last season to get people to watch it.
That show could probably turn me against Amanda Tapping I don't know. It's I tried to like that show. I tried to watch the first season all the way through. Couldn't do it.
All right. I do want to send a shout out to Space Cowboy. He says he's in the Philippines and was hoping to hear us talk about the natural disasters that have been happening in the region. There have been a lot of flooding in the Philippines. He says, they say 2012 is the end of the world, but it certainly feels like it's on the way here now. Between multiple returning super typhoons, months worth of rainfall in 24 hours, earthquakes, tidal waves, it appears Southeast Asia is once again the Pacific's plaything. Care to talk about the end of the world in the next show? Yeah, there's been a lot of disaster type stuff happening in Southeast Asia. We even had a tsunami watch here in San Francisco. It wasn't terribly serious, but they did send out an alert based on that. That's one thing that would be very troubling is if we all ended up being in a natural disaster before the movie 2012 came out.
It would be quite ironic, actually, if it came out, you know, right before it was to come out and they couldn't come out because of something to do with the disaster. I mean, that entire region of the planet is like part of the Ring of Fire.
So yeah, right. It's very active.
Very active.
Hey, maybe there's an idea there. Maybe we should plan something really, really cool and awesome, like a movie or a TV show, but in 2018 or 2020, and people would really, really want to be around to see it. So they would make sure that the Earth didn't explode or be flooded or stuff like that. And then we would save the Earth and really solve the climate change problem.
What, do you just keep delaying it, though? Because if you wait till 2020 and then you do it, then it's over and everybody just lets the Earth go to pot again.
Hmm.
Well, you have to plan the sequel for the next time.
Gotcha. All right. Finally, a couple last comments. We talked about food production last time. Sky and Angus, if I'm pronouncing your username correctly, says he thinks a big problem with food production is that so many people don't produce their own food and wouldn't know how if they had to. He goes on to talk about basically the same vein of, you know, how what would happen if the food supply ran out. People, in, he says... A technology expert in San Francisco is totally without the means and is at the will of the person who makes the food. I resemble that remark. I think he's pointing that at us, Roger.
No, I agree, but the flip side is that all civilizations are kind of built on a pyramid. I mean, a triangle where...
That's what gives us civilization is agriculture.
Agriculture, because it frees up other people to do and study specific things, be it, you know, writing, mathematics, science, you know, travel, being able to moving your cargo from one end of the earth to the other. I mean, you could not specialize in those skills if you spent 50% of your day, you know, either, you know, planting crops, you know, harvesting them or butchering your meat. I mean, if you ever look at what goes into food preparation before you get it in the store and cook it, I mean, it's a lot of work. It's not something you
also,
can say, hey, I'm going to do my master's, but at the same time, I'm going to be a hog farmer.
Also, if worse comes to worse, you know, we can always turn to cannibalism and we don't really need to have crops.
Still got to know how to cook. Like
maybe we'd just be eating each other.
Yeah, zombies. And frankly, like zombies. I know how to grow my own food. I grew up growing my own food. And so I take exception to this stereotype of technology experts as being unable to grow their own food. I just want to get that out.
Oh, did you read
it? Yeah. We grew stuff in my, we had like land, we grew stuff. We weren't farmers. We didn't grow food for other people, but we grew all kinds of vegetables.
All of Tom's clothes after he outgrew them went on the scarecrow.
No, you know what? My dad used to crush up dead bugs and use that to keep the other bugs away, and it worked.
Nice.
That's a How would he do it? He would go and gather bugs, because there's just bugs on plants. He'd gather them up, he'd get a fistful of them dead, and then he'd grind up the remains and sprinkle it around on the plants. Huh. Kept the bug population down.
It works?
Yeah. They smelled the other... His theory, I don't know if this is true, was that they saw or smelled the dead bugs and then didn't... I was like, ooh, that's a bad place. Stay away from it.
It's interesting. Normally they tell you, like, you know...
That actually makes sense. I thought you were saying that he would gather a fistful of dead bugs and like show the other ones how he would crush them with his might, and they would get scared.
So, you know, someone
he'd go out, look at this, this is gonna happen to you.
Someone exactly. Told me about a gardener. He told me about a cool trick to get rid of slugs, and I only partially remember. It had something to do with taking a can of beer and cutting it and just leave it with, you know, enough beer, more than half in, and the slugs would be attracted to it because of the yeast, would drink it, get kind of drunk and fall in and drown.
Also, Web412 in the chat room says, pee around your plants to keep the deer away. I had another friend on a hog farm used to do that in his garden.
He would put what on
there? He wouldn't actually pee himself. That they would take animal urine.
Oh, yeah. You know, they sell that now. Mm-hmm. Coyote or wolf urine?
I think it's coyote a lot of times. Yeah, it might be wolf, too. Finally, Matt.
Oh, look at that. We have lots of resources to know how to grow and do stuff.
Actually, that's the next Web 2.0 conference right there. The topic is growing your own food.
Finally, Matt97 read an interview with the leader of the slow food movement, Carlo Petrini, who said that the planet makes enough food for 12 billion people, so it's not an issue of production, but of waste. He stated a statistic that in the U.S. alone, 22,000 tons of food are thrown away every day. He noted that the fridge was built as a way to preserve food, but it's just a step on the way to the garbage bin for many of us. I have to say that definitely happens in our household sometimes. Food just goes bad, thrown away. But I don't necessarily disagree with Carlo Petrini that may be true, but the stuff that I've read says that even without waste, we are getting close to a point where we may not be able to grow enough food for everyone. I think I may have overstated it last week in saying we aren't. We are growing enough food for everyone right now, and there is a lot of waste. But as the ability to get more crops out of the ground, it starts to level out, which is happening, and the population goes up and up and up. Where it's something to be concerned about.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, to produce more people, you actually need something. You need you need foodstuffs in order to make that happen. So, you know, it could very well be people just feel like, you know, hey, I don't have enough food. I can't have kids. What am I going to feed them with? And thereby the population goes back down. Or, you know, you go by the general economic theory that as people tend to do better, the number of kids they actually have levels off. Except for the U.S., which strangely, alone amongst developed nations, still has a growing population, even without immigration.
That's because of all the big cars and the companies encouraging us to consume and make more of us.
You know, if these minivans held only four people instead of eight,
we just grow families to fit the minivans. That's the problem. All right, folks, thanks for listening or watching, depending on how you consumed it. Also, a big thanks to everybody who went and filled out our listener survey. I know it's quite long and extensive, but many of you have gone and filled it out. If you haven't and you would like to help us out, please do. Go to subbrilliant.com/EMW, click on the We're Listening button, and fill out the listener survey. It helps the company Podtrac to sell some ads for us. So, you know, putting the cards on the table there, we're asking you to help us make money off of the podcast, but so you don't have to.
And I do a testimonial here.
Sure.
I did it, and it was tons of fun. So you should do it too.
All right. And of course, for absolutely no obligation, you can leave comments on the episodes at subbrilliant.com/EMW, getting some conversations with other folks who listen to the show. And thanks again, Patrick Beja, for hanging out with us this week. Appreciate your insights, as always. And give one people one last plug so they can find you.
Twitter.com/NotPatrick. That's the easiest way. Not Patrick. That's me.
Even though he is Patrick. It's sort of a
yes, that's
enigma,
the
conundrum. All right, we'll see you later, folks.
Cool. Bye.